B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, July 16th, 2020. Twitter suffers a humiliating hack of some of its biggest, most well-known account holders. And the NSA is warning us that Cozy Bear is snooping, trying to find information on vaccine development here in the United States. So yesterday was a brazen hack here at San Francisco's Twitter. And let me put my bias out there from the start. I don't like Twitter. I use it lightly. I'm annoyed that I get these tweets from Trump that Twitter is so-called recommending to me. And I'd love for the whole thing just to go away. All right. That said, this cranky old man reports that yesterday, hackers with an unusual gambit were able to impersonate Joe Biden, Barack Obama, Kanye West, I guess he's a presidential candidate, Bill Gates, and I haven't seen, and Elon Musk. I haven't seen that Trump's account was affected. But what they did was take control of these accounts and then tweet out messages saying, if you send me $1,000 in Bitcoin, I'll send you $2,000 back. Now, this is the digital equivalent of a crazy chain letter. And apparently, some people fell for it. I guess if Barack sent some people a message that, send me money and I'll double it, there are people who have enough faith in Obama that they would do that. Apparently $100,000 was coughed up by people and collected by these unknown hackers. Now, they didn't try to do anything important. And this is not the first time that Twitter has been hacked. The messages were a version of a long-running scam in which hackers pose as public figures, promise to match or even triple any funds that are sent to their Bitcoin wallets. In the past, hackers have created fake accounts to try to convince users that the funds will be going to public figures like Elon Musk or Bill Gates. But this is the first time that the real accounts of public figures were used in the scam. And so Twitter had to shut down parts of its platform as it attempted to discover and plug the vulnerability that permitted this to happen. But I will note that about 6:15 Pacific time yesterday, Donald Trump's account was working because I was served up another one of those unsolicited messages announcing that Brad Parscale had been demoted in the Trump campaign. And he's being replaced by one of Chris Christie's pals from New Jersey. And so I was not expecting that news. I was not surprised by that news. Probably had something to do with the low turnout at the Tulsa comeback rally just a couple of weeks back. So the new campaign manager is Bill Stepien. He's the Jersey boy who had to be fired by Chris Christie after the Bridgegate scandal got a little bit too hot for the big boy. And he's kind of described as a methodical, data-oriented guy. And I think Parscale also got in trouble because he put his own face and, promoted himself in a recent Trump TV or online ad. And you can never upstage the stable genius. At any rate, the other hacking news from yesterday is blamed on Russia, on APT-29, a.k.a. Cozy Bear. Remember Cozy Bear? We were told that that was the name given to the unit of the Russian GRU that was allegedly responsible for hacking into the Democratic National Committee servers in 2016 and serving up the spoils to WikiLeaks. And if you're a regular listener, you know that I consider that to be bullshit. and that we have substantial evidence now that no hack ever occurred. But what they're now telling us is that Cozy Bear is trying to hack into the websites at various research sites that are working on coronavirus vaccines. The Russian hackers allegedly have been targeting British, Canadian, and American organizations researching vaccines using spear phishing and malware to try to gain access. The director of Britain's National Cybersecurity Center, Paul Chichester, quote, "We condemn these despicable attacks against those doing vital work to combat the coronavirus pandemic." So immediately Russia is mentioned, and Americans get little goosebumps or hives, hackles are raised, Putin is demonized. But can we put this in a little context and not consider this an act of war? The U.S. Cyber Command has disclosed that 80% of its budget is devoted to hacking other countries. Meaning, on a given day, we're trying to hack into various sites in Russia and in other countries around the world. And so it cannot be surprising that other nations work to hack our digital infrastructure. And so I think people jump to some sort of, dark and sordid potential explanation when the fact is we don't know what the motivation is. Even we don't know if this story is true. But let's just assume that the NSA is not lying to us this time. Well, one motive on the part of Russia would be to raise its periscope in enemy waters and say, how y'all doing with your vaccine development? Because in a separate story in the same update section of the New York Times today, they report Russian officials are hoping to have the first coronavirus vaccine approved in the world after mass production large-scale testing this summer. That's according to the head of the country's sovereign wealth fund, Kirill Dmitriev. Head of Russian Direct Investment Fund, told Reuters the first phase of testing had concluded this week and yielded positive results. A phase two trial would end August 3rd, shortly followed by a larger phase three. We believe that based on the current results, it will be approved in Russia in August, in other countries in September, making it possibly the first vaccine to be approved in the world. Now, I am wary of any of this rushed vaccine development. But this could be the explanation that Russia is seeking advantage over the U.S. and other countries in trying to show that its scientists are better and faster than ours, and also to deal with a serious outbreak of the coronavirus in Russia. So I offer this as my speculation. We're not being told in any of the media accounts what the motivation that Russia might have in doing this alleged hacking. But I raise the point that not all hacking is an act of war. Oh, like what we did to Iran with the Stuxnet virus. And that when Russia is included in a headline, the alarm bells go off now for many Americans in a Pavlovian way. I think Pavlov was Russian. Let's research that. Could be another scary thing for Americans to worry about. Well, once again, the United States Supreme Court stayed up all night to make sure that an execution occurred in Terre Haute, Indiana. This time, 68-year-old Wesley Perkey was murdered by the state, despite the fact that he has Alzheimer's, that his attorneys have asserted in court filings that he thinks he was being executed because he had complained about conditions in the federal prison system. But that didn't matter to the five conservatives on the Supreme Court. In a burst of orders issued just before 3 a.m. today, the court ruled for the government. It dismissed two injunctions that had been placed by a district court judge named Chutkan. And the liberal justices went to their keyboards and cranked out some dissents, one by Justice Breyer, repeating his call for the court to consider whether the death penalty itself is unconstitutional. He said the two cases so far this week, there's a third pending, raise questions of arbitrariness, delays inherent in the death penalty and legal procedure. He also wrote that the issues highlighted in federal and state cases suggest problems with the punishment itself, rather than any particular case. In another dissent written by Sotomayor, joined by Kagan, Ginsburg, and Breyer. Ginsburg, by the way, spent a little time in the hospital, but we're told she's okay. That dissent said that Chutkan was not tasked with answering if Perkey could understand why he was being executed. Instead, Chutkan had to determine if Perkey met the burden of showing that he warranted a competency hearing. And Sotomayor reported or wrote that Chutkan had correctly concluded that he did. And the proceeding with Perkey's execution in such a rushed fashion, despite the grave questions and factual findings regarding his mental competency, casts a shroud of constitutional doubt over the most irrevocable of injuries. And once again, it was at roughly 8 a.m. local time that the legal matters were swept aside and a lethal injection of pentobarbital was used to dispatch Perkey, to his maker. And he did apologize to his victims, and he also criticized the process of his execution. And he also criticized the process of his execution in his final statements. Also, the court, without explanation, lifted an injunction in Florida. They declined to extend a stay on a matter from an appeals court, which is threatening to prevent up to 600,000 former felons in Florida from voting in November. We've covered this before. The issue is that the voters of Florida, by an overwhelming margin, approved restoration of voting rights to former felons who have served their sentences. And the Republicans couldn't let this stand, and so in their latest effort at voter suppression, they passed laws that are like Jim Crow, poll tax laws. They said, well, you not only have to have completed your sentence, but you have to pay all fines and fees and restitution that were ordered at the time of your conviction. And the Republican majority on the court, we actually don't have a vote count. It's possible the Democrats joined in this, but they chose not to take up the case. But I'm going to take up the case of the First Amendment rights of one Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer, the guy who is serving a sentence for his role in the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. He was released in May from a federal prison in upstate New York to home confinement over concerns of COVID. And at the time, I said that, I err on the side of humanity and that I really don't oppose the compassionate release of almost any prisoner in the United States during the current pandemic. But then abruptly last week, he was called in for a meeting with his parole officers, and he thought he was going to be fitted for that ankle bracelet that would be an accessory for the remainder of his home confinement. So he thought it would be a routine meeting. He was stunned when they asked him to sign an agreement that he thought would limit his First Amendment rights. And after he expressed that concern, they called in federal marshals, they handcuffed him, and they dispatched him back to prison. Now, number one, this kind of coercion. That, look, you want to stay at home? You want to be able to order takeout? All you have to do is agree not to publish your next book. And Cohen has indicated to his inner circle that he has a book manuscript that's pretty far along, could be published before the election. And there are people, can you imagine, who don't want that to happen. And I find myself aligned with one of the more odious legal figures in the United States today, who I was just snarky about yesterday, and that's Alan Dershowitz. But I'm with Dersh on this one. Quote, this is the United States. We don't send people to solitary confinement in prison because they want to write a book. Whether you like him or hate him, the idea that he's handcuffed and taken to solitary because he won't sign a form that says I'm not going to write my book, the First Amendment has to have some impact here. Dersh continued, what I see is liberty, our constitutional rights being endangered by the weaponization of our criminal justice system. This is the guy who just 6 months ago was standing on the floor of the Senate uttering irrational, incoherent arguments against the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. Maybe he's trying to rebuild his reputation because of his involvement in the Epstein scandal and his efforts to cover that up. So a Bureau of Prisons spokesman said Cohen was returned to prison for the duration of his sentence because he declined to agree with all of the terms of the federal location monitoring program, most notably electronic monitoring. And Cohen's lawyer said that that's a false claim. That Cohen had repeatedly expressed eagerness to start a home confinement program and comply with all monitoring requirements. So this is Banana Republic stuff. And once again, politics defines the parameters of public debate about this. And to his credit, Dershowitz is speaking out. But Chuck Schumer is the senior senator from New York. He should be defending Michael Cohen. And if he has, it has escaped my notice so far. A good editorial from the New York Times today, slamming the NYPD for their new rules that give cops greater latitude to bar journalists from covering official police activity. The new regulations would add new reasons to revoke reporters' credentials that allow them to go past police lines. The department outlined a litany of offenses that can cost reporters their credentials, including being arrested, being perceived not to be complying with police orders, or conduct that interferes with legitimate law enforcement needs. Now, this is gratuitous, and it's piling on, because we saw in the recent post-George Floyd murder protests in New York, and I referenced yesterday the 64 videos that were put together by the New York Times to show the excessive use of force by the NYPD, including on some reporters. And the abuse of reporters isn't limited to New York. It happened in Minneapolis. It happened in Los Angeles. It happened in Louisville. And so to see the NYPD at a time like this, when they are under such close scrutiny for their bad behavior and policies, to see them move to restrict coverage by the media is really, it's unspeakable. And in New York alone, in June, two AP reporters were shoved and berated by officers, ordered to go home. Shortly after curfew went into effect, even though they were permitted to be there under the rules at the time. And the editorial continues, particularly troubling in the proposed regulations are several that grant officers too much leeway to take a reporter's credentials. The rules govern, for instance, a reporter's misrepresenting the press credential or a perceived attempt to interfere with officers' work. Such rules are written far too broadly and could easily be used to penalize journalists who are simply observing and documenting police actions. Meanwhile, in New York City, there has been a spate of shootings, including some deaths, including a one-year-old child that was killed in the crossfire. And it's leading elected officials, including one who is a former cop, to ask if this is an intentional slowdown in enforcement because the police resent the efforts to rein in their brutal and often illegal behavior. This article reports arrest numbers have plummeted, even as shootings have spiraled up. Elected officials contend that rank-and-file police officers are staging a work slowdown in response to protests over police brutality and systemic racism that erupted after the death of George Floyd. But police officials say they believe that their inability to curb the shooting stems from the need to shift police resources to the protests, as well as a hostile political climate that has made officers reluctant to carry out arrests because of what they see as unfair scrutiny of their conduct. Typically, gun violence rises in the summer as warmer weather draws more people outside, tempers flare. But this year, the violence has been especially fierce in cities across the country. The COVID outbreak has deepened the endemic problems that often underlie gun violence, including poverty, unemployment, housing instability, and hunger, according to crime experts. Michael Sean Spence at the agency called Every Town for Gun Safety says this is a perfect storm. The pandemic has exacerbated the root causes of gun violence. And at the same time, the unrest has eroded trust in the police. Along with New York, shootings have risen. It really started around the 4th of July, including Chicago, Houston, Atlanta, and Denver. In New York, they say the shootings show no signs of slowing. At least 44 people were shot between Monday and Thursday morning, including a 16-year-old who was wounded walking in Brooklyn. So who do you believe? Do you believe that officers are intentionally refusing to investigate, declining to actively try to pursue the shooters in these cases? Well, through July 12th of this year, there were 634 shootings throughout New York, compared to just under 400 in the same period last year. And last year, they've made arrests in 23% of the shootings. I'm sorry, last year it was 30%. This year it is 23%. Now, 20% of the force has been out sick, partly due to the pandemic. There are officers filing for retirement who are frustrated with the shift in the politics of policing. So we'll continue to watch this, but it is a concern, and this is where police extract their ultimate power. The other day, Donald Trump told CBS, when he was asked by a reporter why African Americans are still dying at the hands of police, and Trump had this bizarre reaction, well, so are white people. In fact, even more white people are killed by police, and he said it was a terrible question. Well, interesting commentary under the byline of Malaiki Jabali, at The Guardian today. And she notes, as I did, that numerically it is fair to say in absolute numbers more white people experience police violence because there are more white people. But African Americans are 2.5 to 3 times more often than white Americans to be killed at the hands of police officers. But what Trump didn't really figure out is that he was actually saying that police killings are a serious problem, even though he wants to downplay their impact on black Americans. And this flies in the face of his tough-on-crime, law-and-order stance, as he tries to channel Nixon and, as I've mentioned, George Wallace with the racism angles from 1968. And in the op-ed, she writes, Trump didn't raise any of these arguments and counter them. He didn't actually dispute that the police kill black people. He essentially said, even more people are killed than we talk about. Gotcha. Perhaps it would be more likely that we could create more peaceful, thriving communities if even more white people grasped how police repression and incarceration harm all of us. So there's some good comments in there. I have linked to the op-ed in the show file for today's podcast if you want to take a look. I mentioned that Berkeley was on the verge of some police reform legislation, and after a 9-hour meeting last night, actually it was Tuesday night into Wednesday morning, they agreed to a sweeping set of new public safety reforms, including cutting the police department budget in half, and creating a Department of Transportation to reduce traffic stops by armed officers. So this package passed 8-0, and it included one abstention, and that is Councilwoman Cheryl Davila. She abstained, saying that she wanted deeper cuts, that she wanted to require police to pay for their own misconduct settlements. And at a June council meeting, well, actually at yesterday's meeting, she reacted to a comment by Berkeley's police chief at a June meeting by offering a vote of no confidence in Andrew Greenwood, because Greenwood had been asked how the police department responds to Black Lives Matter protesters and without the so-called less lethal tasers and rubber bullets. And Greenwood said, firearms. We can shoot people. If you're being attacked with lethal force, if we don't have less lethal that can drive it back, then we're absent a tool. So he was arguing for tasers and tear gas and those things as a way of avoiding using their guns, lethal weapons. And he didn't say it very artfully. So I'm pleased to see that progress, and I think that the whole concept of removing traffic stops from the duties of armed police, except in cases where the individual is armed or dangerous, makes a lot of sense. Joan Aleto is our correspondent in Seattle, and he reports that daily protests continue. And now what is being called CHOP 2.0, homeless and protesters are camped on Seattle Central College's lawn, right outside a former CHOP barrier. The area is a designated protest zone under the college's rules, but not designated for camping. So the Seattle Central Community College claims that the encampment is not allowed on their premises and that they didn't authorize it and that the tents must move. School President Edward Lang made his position clear in a letter to staff and students, claiming the voluntary dismantling of the area should happen in a few days, or else they will be forced to call upon the city and the Seattle Police Department to remove the encampment to protect the health and safety of our community. And as a comment Jonah offers, it appears that a CHOP 2.0 sweep is in the works as the city continues a pattern of driving its homeless and protester populations from place to place. In other news, Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan has asked a King County judge to reconsider the decision to approve a recall regarding tear gas. Durkan claims that as mayor, She has no obligation to manage the police, and her attorney wrote that Mayor Durkan has no legal or constitutional duty to prescribe policies and procedures for the Seattle Police Department. And that attorney wrote, "If individual officers' actions violated these policies, petitioners fail to set forth any evidence that Mayor Durkan or Chief Best intended this result." And Durkan further clarified her position on public radio KUOW on Thursday. Regarding the mayor's control of the police department, Durkan says she confers regularly with the chief, gives directives from time to time, but claims she has no duty to direct the police, and thus only the police chief is responsible. She called the police chief's decision to use tear gas a reasonable decision. On defunding the police, the mayor also said she supports defunding by what she called disinvestment and reinvestment, such as taking away parking enforcement from the police, giving it to the Department of Transportation. The mayor says she agrees that armed officers are not the answer to every problem, but she differs on how much can be cut from the police and proposes about a 20% cut. Community groups are requesting an initial outlay of $3 million in order to prepare to handle the coming caseload from tasks that are shifted away from the police. Thank you for that report, Jonah. In today's New York Times, a kind of scorecard on coronavirus treatments and drugs that are in development. And I think this is a useful effort, but we do have to be skeptical at all times, such as the promotion here of remdesivir as showing strong evidence of efficacy against COVID-19. This is, of course, the drug made by the profiteering Gilead Science here in the Bay Area. It was based on $70 million of taxpayer money invested in the research and development originally to fight Ebola. So they're saying that preliminary data from trials that began this spring suggested the drug can reduce the hospital stays of people with severe cases from 15 to 11 days. But when they get to hydroxychloroquine, oh, they are repeating some of the same stuff we have heard. And I want to be clear that I'm not a scientist and I don't have a final judgment for you on what is shorthand called HCQ. But I have pulled back from my reflexive objection to it just because Trump promoted it. And I feel a little uncomfortable with the way a drug that has been used for a long time is suddenly described as having side effects that are not a risk for people who take it for malaria or other conditions, like rheumatoid arthritis. And so I am willing to allow, not that it's up to me, but to follow hydroxychloroquine and see if additional studies pan it out as a useful treatment for COVID-19. And the most recent study was at Henry Ford Hospital in Detroit. The experts have raised doubts about it. It was not a randomized controlled trial. But despite that, the results, at least anecdotally, showed some promise. And as long as it's not killing people, and I haven't seen any evidence of that, I guess I don't have this strong, negative, it must be banned sort of reaction. The other story in the New York Times today about medicines and vaccines focuses on a well-connected company called Novavax. They just got a $1.6 billion contract to make a coronavirus vaccine. And this is a company that has never brought a vaccine to market before. Now, Novavax, you take that apart, Nova means new. And they are new at the vax game. But they have support from well-placed individuals like executives from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and an organization that's funded by the Gates Foundation called the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. So that coalition has invested almost $400 million in the company's coronavirus vaccine. Novavax made an aggressive push to the U.S. government, and they have been offered or given a $1.6 billion, that's the biggest award from Trump's so-called Operation Warp Speed. Now, we don't even know where this money is coming from in the federal budget. Trump doesn't worry about details like that. But I believe that just like the claims that Russia is very close to a vaccine, that we must be skeptical. We must demand adequate testing, full research, not cutting corners. And we know that vaccine makers enjoy immunity from liability. And that those of us who are on the receiving end of a needle, who are sickened or even perhaps die as a result of a bad vaccine, we get to go to vaccine court. And I only learned recently that such a thing exists. So we will see how all this plays out. Skeptics see Novavax as a classic example of a second-tier player that has survived by limping from crisis to crisis, boosting its stock by promising vaccines for new outbreaks, yet never delivering. In its three decades in business, with a mix of public and private investment, it has developed experimental vaccines for viruses like SARS, MERS, and Ebola that never made it past early safety studies. It's telling, critics say, that even as it has received growing amounts of government and philanthropic support, the company's coronavirus vaccine effort has not attracted any deals with major drug makers. And the New York Times quotes David Maris, managing partner of Phalanx Investment Partners. The market wants you to believe in fairy tales. He said investors wanted to believe that, like Cinderella, the companies that couldn't go to the ball would eventually win the prince. It sometimes happens, he said, and usually it doesn't. Here's our COVID-19 Daily Update, edited by Linda Lewis with my gratitude. The worldwide case count is now 13.6 million cases attributed to coronavirus, with 586,000 deaths. Across the United States, identified 3.5 million cases, and the death toll is now listed at upwards of 138,000. And Texas, where Linda is based, is now the scene of a rapidly spreading outbreak in nursing homes. Nearly 1,000 new infections of nursing home residents reported in the week ending on Friday, July 10th. Most likely it's an undercount. Since last Friday, the state has reported more than 1,800 new cases in nursing home residents. And deaths are rising. 1,173 nursing home residents have died in Texas so far. And this is the clearest case of malfeasance. It's not limited to Texas. It happened in New York. It happened in California. It happened in Massachusetts. After we saw the first cluster in suburban Seattle at a nursing home. And we have seen that roughly 40 to 42% of fatalities from COVID in the United States occur in senior facilities. Our failure to address this shows that we consider the elderly to be disposable. It's really disgusting. And Linda quotes Patty Duquette, a long-term care ombudsman for the state of Texas. We had an opportunity to avoid what we're experiencing right now. We got this chance to see what other states did, what awful things they were experiencing, so we might be ahead of the crisis. Now I'm bracing for more deaths to come and more cases. The head of the CDC is moving into the sycophant category. After seeing his colleague Anthony Fauci sidelined by Trump, Dr. Robert Redfield was kind of adjusting his commentary. And he offered a theory that is causing a lot of head scratching, that the spike across the South that we're seeing right now, it's not necessarily related to the reopenings. He said, something happened in mid-June that we're not confronting right now. It's not as simple as just saying it was related to the timing of reopening. He thinks it was people who traveled from the north to southern states on vacations, carrying the virus with them. Now, we turn to Harvard Global Health Institute Director, Dr. Ashish Jha. He says, first, infection rates don't explode around June 12th to the 16th. Most of southern states saw infections start rising around June 1st, about a week after Memorial Day weekend, not June 12th to the 16th, as Redfield says. Bottom line, he said, is that this is silliness. Yesterday, we reported on this sudden shift that hospitals across the country have been instructed to send their data on COVID, hospitalization rates, seriousness of the cases, and outcomes, including death, not to the CDC, but to a contractor hired by Health and Human Services in Pittsburgh. The surprise left hospitals, researchers, and public health officials scrambling, which is the last thing you want during the height of a pandemic. That's according to former CDC Director Tom Frieden. In the midst of the worst public health crisis in a century, it is counterproductive to create a new mechanism which will be extremely complicated to build and implement. Streams of data that CDC was making available to researchers and the public have suddenly been cut off, exacerbating fears that the Trump administration is trying to stomp out any evidence that the pandemic is worse than ever. And it fits with Trump, who keeps repeating, we only have more cases because we have too much testing. And at the Harvard Chan School of Public Health, epidemiologist William Hanaga is quoted, the Trump administration should be working with CDC, supporting it, and taking the CDC's advice rather than anything other than that. Yeah, like fighting it. Trumpco also apparently led by Deborah Birx, the White House advisor, has this proposal floated to order or ask governors to send National Guard troops to hospitals to gather data. Really? And regarding this shift in the management of data, Rosa DeLauro, the Democrat from Connecticut who chairs the House Budget Committee, has accused HHS of acting in direct violation of the law by ordering hospitals to bypass CDC. Quote, HHS has been operating as a dangerous political apparatus, cannot be trusted to share accurate hospital information with Congress and the American public. And Linda has put together a list of five different websites where you can get accurate COVID information, and I will include each of those links in the show file for today's podcast at peterbcollins.com. And here's a little malaprop from Kayleigh McEnany. She's the new White House press secretary. And in regard to reopening of schools, we'll get to more on that in a moment. She said, when Trump says open, he means open and full, kids being able to attend each and every day at their school. The science should not stand in the way of this. Huh? Really? So, as I have said repeatedly, I don't think that Anthony Fauci walks on water. He's not a candidate for sainthood. But he needs to really step up, fight back, and not allow his reputation to be swift-boated by the Trump White House. And Trump is playing this good cop, bad cop game where he said, oh, I didn't authorize Peter Navarro to write that. Well, Navarro wrote it because he knew Trump would lap it up. He used talking points that Trump has previously used himself. And while Fauci did dismiss this yesterday as bizarre, counterproductive, and bad for the White House, we see Redfield working in a different direction, trying to mollify Trump and hold on to his job. Now more than 1,000 health officials have come to support Fauci. They've published an op-ed countering the op-ed of Peter Navarro. First of all, the people speaking out against Fauci have absolutely no medical credibility, no public health credibility, and frankly, no policy credibility when it comes to any kind of disaster or situation involving human health. We need to see Fauci fight back in the same manner. And USA Today, stung by its publication of the Navarro op-ed, has put a tag on it, saying, we felt it was newsworthy because it expanded on comments that had been in the news. It put an on-the-record name to the attacks on Fauci and contradicted White House denials of an anti-Fauci campaign. So we're seeing, again, various reactions to the expert advice that wearing facial masks can reduce the transmission of the novel coronavirus. And in Georgia, Governor Brian Kemp signed an executive order which on the one hand bans cities from enacting their own mandates about masks, but then encourages citizens of the Peach State to wear a mask. And that kind of incoherence doesn't help anybody. Now, maybe Kemp thinks that it's going to keep him off the Twitter radar of the Donald, but these kinds of preemptive efforts by governors are really ill-considered. So Doug Ducey, Republican of Arizona, and Greg Abbott, Republican of Texas, previously tried to block cities and counties from issuing their own mask orders, but both have since relented. Abbott issued a mask mandate for most counties earlier this month, and Ducey stopped short of requiring them statewide, but allowed cities and counties to go forward with their own regulations. In hard-hit Alabama, Governor Kay Ivey, Republican, issued an order Wednesday requiring people to wear masks in public. She held out for a long time. Democrat Kansas Governor Laura Kelly announced that she would delay the opening of schools until after Labor Day, saying that schools need time to get masks, thermometers, hand sanitizer, and other supplies. France has made masks compulsory in all public indoor areas starting next week. Britain announced similar measures this week with face mask or face coverings compulsory in shops and supermarkets starting July 24th. And one item I missed yesterday that was in my stack is the number of countries that Americans cannot currently travel to. It is most of the exotic and interesting destinations that are popular with American tourists. And Mexico will allow Americans in, but they're not excited about it. And Caribbean countries appear to be the only region that is actually welcoming American tourists right now. And regarding masks, our listener, Paul Leto, he's the dad, sent a note. He said, the mask debate is not so much silly as it is inevitable, given the undemocratic means that have been used to impose far-reaching impacts on people's lives, like shutdowns and masks. They are simply edicts from public health scientists whose names we don't even know, handed down by governors claiming not to be in charge because they're just following the science. Had there been a democratic debate prior to these far-reaching impacts, people might consent to the law in greater numbers. But because no debates occur prior to the law's adoption, the debates must occur after the adoption and take the form of resistance and political identification. The solution, he says, is more democracy, but currently we have none. And I do take your point, Paul. And I agree that people can react to these as arbitrary impositions by unelected powers. But most state laws do give these authorities to public health officials. And if this is not the situation that triggers those authorities, well, I don't know what would be. Meanwhile, related to schools, the New York Times notes that while many public schools have plans for partial reopening of classrooms or full online education, many neighboring private schools have prepared to open full-time. And the answer is simple, they've got more money. And they have wealthy parents who can support the efforts for better hygiene, better distancing. They already have smaller class sizes in very many cases. And the New York Times makes this statement, which I consider false. Most countries in which schools have opened after reducing infection levels and imposing distancing measures have not had new outbreaks. And we just reported to you yesterday about Israel, where 47% of new infections occurred in people connected to the school environment after schools reopened. And in Detroit today, 11 people were arrested after they blocked the exit of a school bus, a school bus depot, to protest a district's decision to hold voluntary in-person summer school during the pandemic. The protests have been ongoing since summer school started on Monday. The Detroit Public Schools Community District said that because of protesters, 20% of students who had signed up for summer school were unable to get to school. The demonstrations were organized by a group called By Any Means Necessary, arguing that there is no way to safely resume in-person classes and that reopening uses school children as guinea pigs. And I think they have a fair argument. We're learning that the number of people who have already lost their health insurance because they lost their jobs and the coverage provided by their employers has lapsed is 5.4 million. It screams for Medicare for All. And I was screaming at the TV last night when Bernie Sanders was there. He acknowledges that Joe Biden is not a single-payer supporter, but he continues to promote Biden by using the lesser of two evils argument and by claiming that Biden has moved in the direction of expanding Medicare, lowering the qualifying age from 60 from 65 or 66, and a couple of other modest proposals. But Bernie, I'm sorry, I'm not buying what you're selling. Apple got a big break from an antitrust regulator in the European Union as a court overruled a 2016 decision that had ordered Apple to pay almost $15 billion in unpaid taxes to the nation of Ireland. And this shows that Apple is one of the biggest tax cheats in the world, because that money that they don't have to pay Ireland is not going to be paid in taxes in the United States. That's the whole reason Apple set up its European headquarters in Cork, Ireland. And I thought that the EU was going to really force Apple to pay up. But I'm sorry to say that's not going to happen. During protests in St. Louis on June 28th, there was a photo taken that went viral as the owners of a mega mansion, Mark and Patricia McCloskey, defended their property by brandishing weapons. Mark McCloskey trotted out some sort of assault weapon. His wife brandished a pistol at demonstrators who were marching to the mayor's home in the same neighborhood. Now, the McCloskeys felt threatened by this crowd. We're not aware of anybody in the crowd who was armed. And so it does appear to be, at minimum, an overreaction. And the local prosecutor is looking into it. And her name is Gardner, Kim Gardner. She is a liberal prosecutor. And the right-wing Senator Josh Hawley, the right-wing governor, they are in a conspiracy with Donald Trump now to turn this into some sort of a national cause in support of Second Amendment rights to own a weapon and point it at people, even if you don't shoot it. And so the senator is calling for the federal Justice Department to investigate the local prosecutor in an effort to get her to drop her investigation. It's grandstanding, it's meddling, and it's pandering of the lowest order. Speaking of which, I have never tasted Goya foods, but they're now a cause celeb on the right because there is a boycott from the left of Goya foods after its CEO went to the White House and praised Donald Trump. So Trump took a picture in the Oval Office with an array of Goya products on his desk, a disgusting merchandising moment that we've never seen from a president. And his favorite daughter, Ivanka, tweeted a photo of herself holding up a can of Goya beans, hoping to support this Hispanic-owned business that she says has been unfairly treated. Well, in this case, Trump is above the law, but Ivanka is not. She is subject to the terms of, I believe in this case, it's the Hatch Act, which prevents government employees from using their jobs to promote a candidate and to promote products. Noah Bookbinder, the executive director of CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, says the ethics rules for executive branch employees say that you can't use your official position to promote a private business. It's pretty clear that the context in which this came out is that Goya had been supportive of the Trump administration, and the Trump administration is scratching back. Interesting commentary at Mint Press News today under the byline of Reva Enteen, who says that she's been working in San Francisco as a social worker. And she opens by talking about how Kamala Harris, who may be a vice presidential pick, she's currently a U.S. senator, is not all that progressive. And she writes, after the DNC cheated Bernie Sanders twice, many of his supporters launched the Movement for a People's Party. Polls show that a large majority of Americans want a major new party, support progressive policies, and want money out of politics. That means that it is both possible and necessary for us to build a corporate-free, progressive populist party. So she makes the case that it's time to ditch the Democratic Party. The U.S. is the only country with an absolute two-party system and an electoral college that can change the results of a popular vote, creating a winner-take-all that prevents any meaningful challenge to the duopoly. American voter turnout in presidential elections is usually barely in the mid-50% range. The U.S. doesn't only have low voter turnout because so many people are uninspired by either party. There are also significant hurdles to voting in the U.S., and I will add there are significant hurdles to people outside the two major parties getting on the ballot. Somebody should tell Kanye West. She goes on, even more concerning is the Democrats outflanking Trump from the right in foreign policy. While we face both a public health and unemployment crisis and a sustained protest movement against police abuses, a massive $740 billion military spending package was approved last week by the Democratic-controlled House Armed Services Committee. My concern, she says, is that we're not equal to the task before us. As a feminist for over half a century, I found that sexism is alive and well in a national political organization I started working with. In response to a woman saying she doesn't think women are treated with equal respect, an elder activist white man said, well, it wasn't intentional. She closes by saying that we need to practice pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. We need to take ourselves seriously, Fascism will not be the FBI coming to our door. It will not look like fascism under Hitler, Mussolini, or Franco, but it is coming. Are we ready? She asks. And finally, I have linked to a lengthy article in today's New York Times, which explains why Colin Powell, who was George W. Bush's Secretary of State, and who gave a speech that he knew to be false to the United Nations on February 5th of 2003, which provided the basis, the rationale, for the U.S. invading Iraq without a coalition, without a United Nations mandate, and without any evidence of the claimed weapons of mass destruction that had been developed, they said, by Saddam Hussein. It's an interesting piece, and Colin Powell in the past has declined to talk about this. He's used Lawrence Wilkerson as a proxy to explain his embarrassment at being the mouthpiece for bullshit. And he told Jack Straw, the British Foreign Secretary, "I knew I didn't have any choice. What choice did I have? He's the president." And so this is an interesting effort to scrub the soiled reputation of Colin Powell. And I find him far less offensive and complicit with the operators in the Bush administration led by Dick Cheney and Dick Rumsfeld, who wanted war no matter what. But what this article does is explain in some detail that there were CIA people who didn't believe the CIA assessments, and that in particular the use of Curveball, the guy who claimed there were these portable weapons labs, that 2 days before Powell gave his speech, the CIA knew that Curveball was not credible, and were told that they didn't tell Colin Powell that. I'm not sure what the truth is here, but if Colin Powell wants to rehabilitate his reputation, he's got to do a lot more apologizing than this kind of weasel approach in the New York Times. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You can share it with absolutely everyone. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails.